Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Our throwaway culture is very much alive and well. Most of what we eat, drink, use comes to us packaged in petroleum plastic, which is designed to last forever. We use billions of bags and bottles, toys, gadgets, you name it, which are rarely recycled. Only a paltry 5% of the plastics produced is recovered. Roughly 50% winds up in landfills, some remade into durable goods, but much unaccounted for, lost in the environment where it ultimately washes out to sea. That's where the Five Gyres Institute comes in, the organization that researches plastic pollution across the world's oceans, engaging communities in finding solutions. Gyres, by the way, are circular patterns of currents in an ocean basin. Anna Cummins, my guest today, is executive director of the Five Gyres Institute. She and her husband, Dr. Marcus Erickson, co-founded the organization in 2009 after realizing there was a gap in global research on plastic pollution. A year earlier, she was part of a month-long 4,000-mile research expedition studying plastic debris in the North Pacific Gyre. And get this, it was there and then that Dr. Erickson proposed. They tied the knot during a 2,000-mile biking speaking tour that took them from Vancouver to Mexico. In 2011, Five Gyres completed the first global survey on plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. That same year, Anna was named a fellow of Wings World Quest, a nonprofit that serves as the leading resource and advocate for female explorers worldwide. Anna, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with this really important question. How did you and plastic come together? And is our pollution problem worse than ever?
So, starting with how I got interested in this issue, I've always been an ocean person. I grew up in Santa Monica. My first sort of activism was doing beach cleanups as a kid in high school. But it wasn't until 2001, I was in graduate school at the time studying environmental policy, and I heard a talk, a lecture from a man named Captain Charles Moore, who is largely credited as the one who discovered the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And I was floored to hear about this massive area of the Pacific Ocean, and no one was talking about it in my graduate school program. So that began a 13-year quest that brings me to where I am today. I began volunteering with his organization. In 2004, I had a chance to go out to Guadalupe Island off the coast of Baja, and there I saw firsthand what's happening with our plastic. I saw every single bird, these Laysan albatross, had stomachs full of plastic pollution. And then in 2007, I met my now husband, Dr. Marcus Erickson. He invited me to cross the gyre with the Algalita Marine Research Institute, and there in the middle, as you mentioned in the beginning, he fished out a little piece of plastic pollution, knit a little blue ring, and proposed right then and there.
Oh, this is crazy.
I thought that was very romantic, and that led me to where I am today. I said yes.
Yeah, by the way, yes, of course you said yes. Are you still wearing that plastic ring?
Actually, this ring is one that he made me out of an old quarter. As you can tell, we're very into recycling. So this is a quarter that he beat with a spoon over and over until it flattened out, and he was able to scoop out the middle with a knife. And this is my ring.
So you really met your environmental soulmate, didn't you?
I did indeed.
And you two have been on this mission and will continue to probably be on this mission for the rest of your lives.
Absolutely. We now have a toddler, so we're more committed than ever to a life of sustainability. But it was on that trip in the middle of the ocean, a couple things happened to me there in 2008, crossing the gyre. For one, it was the first time I'd had a chance to see firsthand
how bad
this vast region. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is that when you're out in the middle of the gyre, it's actually blue, pristine water as far as the eye can see. It's only when you really look down and start tracking little pieces floating by. It's not a patch or an island as it's been conveyed in the media. But every 2 minutes, there's a plastic bottle cap or a lighter or a little fragment, and it's relentless.
But is that coming from somebody who's boating there and is just tossing a bottle of water into the water, or is this a much more concentrated effort?
It's a mixture. I mean, so what you're referring to, there have been some studies, and these range, of course, widely across the world. But in the Pacific, roughly 20% is estimated to come from boaters, from cruise ships, from the fishing industry. The rest of it comes from land.
The fishing industry? I mean, you're out there
you wouldn't
trawling
believe,
and,
yeah.
and you're tossing your garbage into the water?
Well, it's lost nets, it's buckets, it's buoys, it's fishing floats. I mean, you name it, and we've seen it out there. And I think we've had until recently this idea of an infinite ocean. You know, our planet is a water planet, and most people, you know, that it used to be the solution to pollution is dilution. We used to believe the oceans are so vast that, you know, any garbage that we toss in is just a drop in the bucket, but we're now seeing that that's not the case. But I wanted to share with you something else from that voyage. I had read about and heard about plastic pollution. I knew that it was affecting animals. You've seen images, I'm sure, of animals with six-pack rings, all that stuff. But what was new for me on that trip is we actually brought home these small fish. They're at the base of the food chain. They're called lanternfish or myctophids. We brought 660 of them back to land and found roughly a third had plastic in their stomachs.
Oh, my God.
And there have been studies since by Scripps, one that showed 9% of these myctophids had plastic in their stomachs. So the point is that plastic is now getting into the food chain that you and I depend on. And that was frightening for me.
And that was something that beforehand you were unaware of?
I was not aware of it. I mean, I've learned a lot since then. I've learned that this is actually more common than I knew to find plastic in the stomachs of fish. But in that moment, seeing plastics in the stomachs of fish and also having my husband propose with this little piece of garbage, we decided to get married, but that we wanted to do something really big first before we got married. And that was my husband's idea to build a boat out of 15,000 plastic bottles, which he and a friend of ours sailed then from Long Beach back to Hawaii through the gyre.
Okay. I don't know where to begin with you. So how long did it take to build a boat with 15,000 bottles?
Well, he had built a few boats. And just a quick word on his story. He is a Gulf War veteran. He was served in the first Gulf War as a Marine. And it was there he saw the connection between petroleum, the men that were sending overseas to fight, and securing access to foreign oil. So that was the click for him. He committed during that Gulf War to, when he got out, make a boat and go down the Mississippi River. Which he did, but as a poor graduate student, he had just gotten his PhD, what was readily available was garbage. So he made his boat out of garbage, and that led to making increasingly larger boats. And so when we met, the idea was to do something shocking to get people's attention to the issue and really to draw them to the science of what we were seeing on that trip, plastic in the food chain.
Mm-hmm. And did it work?
Yeah, it was crazy enough and risky enough. In retrospect, I had no idea how risky it was at the time, but it took 2.5 months to build this boat. It was about the size of a boxing ring, if that gives you an image. Maybe about 24 by 20.
Which we had slept on?
I was on land. So my husband and our friend Joel Pascal sailed on junk, we call the boat junk, from Long Beach to Hawaii. And the point was to do something outlandish to draw media attention, to draw new eyes and ears to this issue of the fact that plastic is no longer just an aesthetic issue. It's actually getting into the food chain that we depend on.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take them to make the sail?
It took us 2.5 months to build the boat. It took them 3 months to sail it.
And how many miles is that from California to Hawaii?
They sailed about, they didn't do a straight shot, so they sailed about 2,800 miles.
And did it garner tremendous press?
It did. I mean, we were a small—
Were they calling it Erickson's folly? I mean, did people take it seriously?
People did. We had CNN do a couple of reports. We were a small, scrappy team of three people.
Right.
And we've grown and learned a lot about PR since then. But we had over 1 million people follow the boat the day it landed. And then what was great is that Marcus got on Martha Stewart after that to do a little show here in New York.
I'm going to do a little bit of jumping around.
Yes.
Because before I did research on you, I have to confess I never heard the word gyre. I said what it meant, but I must also confess that I didn't know what I was talking about.
You're not
about.
Alone there.
Circular patterns of currents in an ocean basin. What does that mean?
Yeah. So a lot of people are not yet familiar with this word, but we're hoping that as our organization grows and as the issue gets out there, more people will have heard of a gyre. We're also starting to call them, and they've been called a lot, garbage patches. And even though that brings up an image of a solid mass, it still is more concentrated within the gyre and without. So a gyre is just a circular— Think of a vortex, and it's a massive circular system comprised of prevailing winds and the Earth's rotation and these currents, and they're thousands of miles wide. And the issue is that plastic, floating plastic, because half of plastic sink, and that's a whole other issue we can go into.
Mm-hmm.
But the stuff that floats and gets into our oceans from storm drains, from watersheds, from rivers, it gets swept up into these massive current systems, circulating around and around and around. And because plastic is not biodegradable, it can remain out there for a very long time. But what happens is that it's photodegradable. Sunlight will break it down into these little fragments that are now, you know, being mistaken for food by animals.
Aha. And so that really exacerbates the problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. These broken down particles that are, you know, very durable.
Now, your institute is Five Gyres Institute because there are five gyres in the world.
There are five subtropical gyres, big gyres. There are actually 11 gyres total. There are smaller gyres, subpolar gyres. But the big ones are the five major oceans. So when I first started getting into this issue, there was a fair amount of research on the North Pacific Gyre, what people call the Texas-sized island or the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. That was the ocean I crossed with my husband and Al Galita in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got back from that trip and we started doing more outreach, people kept asking, what about the other oceans? Is this an issue globally? So that was our impetus to start Five Gyres and really take this issue to a global level.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Anna Cummins. She is executive director of the Five Gyres Institute, an organization she and her husband co-founded in 2009 after realizing there was a gap in global research on plastic pollutions. What isn't made of plastic?
What isn't?
I mean, when you think about it, we're just so surrounded by it.
Okay, that's a great point. I mean, we often say it's difficult to go into a supermarket and not find something that's made of plastic, packaged in plastic, or labeled with plastic.
Exactly.
You know, as a conscious consumer or citizen, a nicer word, we can look for things that are packaged in paper or glass or aluminum or things that are truly recyclable. And all plastics are not created equal either. For example, water bottles, PET plastic, is more recoverable and recyclable. Some states have redemption programs, or the bottle bill, as we call it. But globally, and you mentioned this, in the U.S., our recovery and recycling rates are abysmally low. They're something like 5 to 8%.
Because?
Part of it is economics. We don't have a massive market yet for recycled products. PET is very much in demand. The water bottles that we use are very much in demand because those are very easily recycled. But most of our recycling in this country, we actually ship overseas to India, to China, because it's expensive and because there isn't yet a great demand for recycled products.
So what are they doing with it?
They're also, you know, some of it is downcycled. Some of it is likely winding up in the incinerator or the landfill. And some of it is turned into lower grade products, things like carpeting or fleece or lumber, things like that.
And we can't be bothered here in the States to do this?
Well, we're working on it.
Oh, boy. Is it that we have to demand zero tolerance for plastic products, for plastic pollution?
Pollution, yes. You know, plastic is an amazing material. I'm not anti-plastic by any means. I mean, I'm carrying around in my bag today a computer and a cell phone and all kinds of things. It's just that we shouldn't be using this insanely valuable material to make throwaway products. And that's one of the main messages we're trying to get out with Five Gyres.
So talk about that.
So single use, our obsession with convenience and single use, this culture of convenience that we've created, that's what we're trying to address with people, that it makes no sense to be taking plastic and making things like plastic bags or plastic straws or water bottles or things like that that we use one time and just throw away.
Why can't we just have paper?
Well, you're touching on a couple things here. I mean, and one is just the need for greater public awareness. And just by having this show and sharing this with your listener, you're taking a great leap to just educate people about this issue. Education alone, I don't believe, is going to solve the problem, though. And we need better policies at the municipal level and even at the state and the federal level. And we also need more responsibility from producers. We started massively producing plastic in the 50s, and it came out of the war effort that we discovered ways to make plastic, and there was this boom with the war. And then post-war, we needed to find new uses for plastic, and that became the average household, replacing a lot of our durable goods with cheap throwaway disposable products. So really, I think it's a design issue. And I'm going to share one example that I think illustrates that if companies really design products to be more recoverable, more recyclable, and not have no value at the end of their life cycle.
Right.
A plastic bag, you have little incentive to do anything with it. It has no value. Water bottles, again, in states where you have a 10-cent return on that, you don't see the kind of pollution from plastic water bottles in states that have a bottle bill. So if we could put that sort of incentive for your average person, if there was a nickel or a dime value to plastic waste products, you wouldn't see them littering our streets. You would see people recovering them.
Who are the biggest offenders?
You know, in this country, we are some of the biggest offenders. You know, you can kind of look to the oceanic gyres to see where's the biggest problem. And we have the biggest problem in the Pacific. And that's because we have huge consumer countries surrounding the Pacific Rim. But I would say in this country, you know, we produce upwards of 100 billion pounds of plastic in the U.S. alone. And our recovery rates before, as we talked about, are in the 5% range. So you can see there's a huge gap between what we produce and what we recover. And one of the places, unfortunately, we're seeing that gap is in the ocean.
You were talking about cosmetics, for example, right? Isn't that a real thorn in your side?
Yeah. So I'm going to share with you an example, and I brought a little visual. We can describe it for your listeners.
For sure.
We've done all this research in the oceans. We found plastic globally. We started 2 years ago, though, doing some of the same research in the Great Lakes. And we found in Lake Erie one sample that had more plastic than any of the oceans by count. What we found under a microscope is that these almost 1,600 little particles of plastic in this one lake sample were little plastic beads from personal care products, things like toothpaste, facial scrubs, body washes. Products that have exfoliants are now using plastic in them.
If I'm putting an exfoliant on my skin, it has little beads of plastic in it?
Well, not all of them. If you look on the label and it says like apricot kernels or jojoba beads or something natural, then you're good.
Okay.
But if you look on the back of those ingredients on your product and it says polyethylene, then that's plastic. Little tiny plastic beads that we're using to scrub our face, they go right down the drain into our water system.
Who knew?
We had no idea either. But the good news on this, and what I am really encouraged to see how good science can really drive policy, is we took our scientific findings to some big companies, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, L'Oreal, The Body Shop. We showed them our results. We got our community to really engage, write them letters and phone calls. And some of those companies, actually all three of them, committed to a phase-out by 2017, 2015. But what we've done now, and what's relevant to New York, is that we introduced a bill. We sponsored a bill to ban the sale of these products outright, and New York was the first state to introduce our bill.
Wow. And is it in effect today?
It's not in effect today. It was just introduced. It still needs to be voted on. So I would love for your listeners, if this resonates, to go to our website, 5gyres.org, and sign our petition. And we're going to be launching a petition for a national bill. We're trying to gather 100,000 signatures. So that'll be up in the coming weeks.
You know, when you hear people say, well, there's no such thing as global warming and all of this, do you feel like you're just sometimes pushing this ball up the mountain and wonder if you'll ever get to the top?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to be terribly optimistic all the time if you're in the sustainability movement. However, examples like the ones I just shared, where good science coupled with an engaged grassroots community can actually get corporations to shift, That gives me hope.
Did the corporations realize what they were doing, that there were plastic particles in their products? I mean, or did they feign ignorance? I had no idea.
I don't think anyone really connected the dots on this one, that these little plastic beads were so small that they're designed to just slip right through our water system. Some water treatment systems may capture these beads, but we have seen that many of them don't, and there have been studies. Actually, our partner on this project was SUNY Fredonia in New York.
University of New York.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. And Dr. Sam Mason there has done some of her own research on effluent testing to see if microbeads are escaping, and sure enough, they are.
Once again, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Anna Cummins, who is Executive Director of the 5gyres Institute. What's the simplest thing?
Simplest thing to do?
Yeah.
So we've talked about a number of things. We talked about single-use throwaway plastics, things that people use one time and throw away. And that's the easiest thing that people can shift. Getting rid of, for example, plastic straws when you go to a restaurant. Just ask for your drink with no straw.
Right.
Bringing your own bag. I mean, these are just the baby steps, but bring your own bag to the supermarket. Don't use those plastic bags. Bring your own cup to the coffee shop, or just get your cup in a porcelain cup. A lot of coffee shops will allow you to do that. Just taking a look at the things that we use on a daily basis and trying to replace single-use disposables with reusable. And it's actually cheaper in many cases.
What about styrofoam?
Styrofoam is a particularly bad one because it's a very difficult to recycle, or it's oftentimes just not recycled. And it's also, it contains a toxic chemical called styrene, which has been shown to leach into food. But I have a good example of that one too.
Great.
So I'm from Los Angeles. We do a lot of work with schools, and this also keeps me fueled that young people really get this issue. We worked with a school in Silver Lake for a couple years. They had their food on styrofoam trays, which is common in many cafeterias across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
These students got really fired up. They did some math. They figured out how much money the school was spending on these trays, throwing them away every day after lunch. They replaced them with reusables, saved the school $12,000, And that got the attention of the entire district of L.A., which is second only to New York's public school
district
system. I was
going to say, which is huge, right.
And they banned these district-wide in Los Angeles, in L.A. Unified School District. So this gives us a lot of hope, too, that when young people get engaged, when communities get engaged, we can make these incremental changes that really have a ripple effect.
Talk about Five Gyres. How did you give birth to this?
So, you know, my husband and I had met doing this work in the oceans. We decided to spend our lives really engaged working on sustainability. We did an outreach tour in 2009. We brought a bunch of our ocean samples, like the one that you see here in this jar that we
Describe
selected.
It.
So I'm holding here this jar of a sample that we collected in the Pacific Gyre. What you see at the top, what looks like these little pebbles, those are plastic particles.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been a toothbrush from 15 years ago. So this handful of plastic is mixed in with a lot of marine life, zooplankton and little krill. And this is what it, you know, this is what we're talking about here. This is the plastic soup. So we brought 100 of these jars with us. We hopped on our bicycles in Vancouver, Canada, and cycled down to Tijuana, Mexico, and gave a bunch of talks along the way. And every talk we gave, someone would always ask, what about the other oceans? What about the other gyres? Is this a problem? Then in Big Sur, we got married. We had met a minister at one of the talks we gave, and she came down and married us. We were wearing plastic bag outfits. very classy ones, I'll have you know, made by an artist. And we decided with our wedding money to start a new organization called Five Gyres and to just go out and do it ourselves. No one else was doing the research south of the equator. So that led to the birth of Five Gyres with a couple of goals. One was, let's just see how big this problem is. Let's go to all Five Gyres, do the scientific research, and publish it.
And your wedding money is what paid for these trips?
No, not by not by any stretch of the imagination.
That would have been that
would have been quite a wedding. No, it was just enough for us to incorporate as a nonprofit and to start fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early, I would say in the early year or two, we were largely funded by corporate partners.
Oh.
Companies like EcoUsable, Patagonia gave us some support. Mm-hmm. Companies that were, Quicksilver Foundation, companies that were like-minded and
who were committed.
Yeah, exactly. And we're now, you know, doing more fundraising through family foundations and individual donors and still corporate partners like Clean Canteen is one of our big partners, and they make reusable stainless steel bottles.
Have you been to all five gyres?
I have.
Where are the other gyres?
Okay, so the North Atlantic was our first expedition. That was our honeymoon, from the Bahamas to Bermuda to the Azores off the coast of Portugal. So that's that gyre between the United States and Europe kind of joins those two continents. So we've got the North Atlantic, the South Atlantic, the North Pacific, the South Pacific, and the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say, you know, what is by and large the worst. The Pacific Gyre tends to have more trash in it because of the consumer nations surrounding it. However, we have found plastic across all five oceanic gyres. But I don't want to depress people. I don't think I fully answered your question about solutions. A couple things that people can do is just, A, look at their own footprint. Avoid single-use disposables, some of the things I mentioned, like the bags and the bottles and the straws and the utensils. Baby steps, just pick one of those.
But you don't have to be a lunatic about it.
No, you can just pick one. If you can pick one behavior change and really stick with it for 7 to 10 days,
I think the straw is just so extraordinary in its simplicity. I mean, I just wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah.
Dump the straws.
Exactly. Exactly. So your listeners can just try that on for a week and a half and see how that feels. Go to a restaurant.
What a deprivation if you don't have a straw.
Ask for your drink with no straw. Uh-huh. And it's also a teachable moment if people look at you kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's what municipalities can do. Things like bag bans, for example, we're seeing sweep the nation. Things like taking the biggest offenders and either putting fees on them or outright bans. You know, that the fee approach may be a good one to incentivize people for good behavior. People can also vote with their pocketbook by supporting companies that are doing the right thing, companies like Clean Canteen or Patagonia. And then companies can take responsibility. There's a policy mechanism that we're big in favor of called Extended Producer Responsibility, EPR. And it's big in Europe and it's starting to hit the U.S. And that's the idea that why should we, the people, have to deal with all this waste that companies are producing? They should really have to deal with it. If companies have to deal with what happens to their waste products after they leave our hands, you can bet they're going to design products that are smarter, that are better designed, that are easier to recover, and that are more recyclable.
You just think that there's some kind of an attitude, as if say they can't be bothered, that a corporation would just say, I just can't be on top of you like Big Brother.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of corporations might say that litter is a people problem, that people litter.
Exactly.
And that is true. People litter, and we need to really do our part, you know, to make sure that our trash goes in the right place. But it also needs to be part of the design. if products are designed so that they have some value after them, then you're not going to see as much litter.
How many people are on your staff?
One of the things that we do is we take people out to sea, and this is now how we've gained most of our staff.
Mm-hmm.
So that first expedition from across the North Atlantic, we fund it in part by having people pay a fee to be on board.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people who joined that first expedition is now our associate director, Stib Wilson, and he also does a lot of our policy and our social media. He was so fired up by getting out to be in a gyre, work with us side by side, see hands-on what are we talking about, that he's now full-time with us. So we're an organization now of 5 people, 4 full-time people and 2 part-time people, and a board of 10.
Describe a day in the life of Anna Cummins and Dr. Marcus Erickson.
I wish I could say I was out on the ocean on the front lines all the time. But, you know, these days for me, I would say I spend half of my time, if not more, with development work, fundraising. And this is maybe the less fun part of running a nonprofit, but very important. Finding strategic partners, finding companies that we can align with, getting our messaging out. What I love doing is public presentations, is going and talking to students and talking to people and really sharing the basics of this issue. Because I find when you share just a little bit, people want to know, how can I do more? What can I do to solve this problem?
People must be stunned by what you impart. Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that kind of thing.
I think this is still an issue that most people aren't really aware of. But one of our hopes is that by doing more of this work in the Great Lakes, for example, is that we can start reaching inland communities that might not have such a connection to the ocean, but they are connected to their local lake, their local watershed, their local river, especially for people who are fishing and deriving their livelihood. But what my husband has been doing is a lot more of the front lines research. So in about just shy of a month, he's going to be sailing from Bermuda to Iceland, crossing the North Atlantic Gyre and the Subpolar Gyre.
Alone?
No.
And in a boat made of bottles?
No, in a normal boat. So we've partnered with a group called Pangea Explorations to do a lot of these expeditions. We charter the vessel. We get a crew of other scientists, journalists, filmmakers, artists, musicians to come on board with us, see firsthand, and then go back to their communities and share.
Now, will this be made, for example, into a documentary, this journey, this voyage?
We're working on it, yeah. We have tons of footage from our other expeditions. We have a couple of just short pieces, but really what we want to do with these next 2 expeditions is produce more content, produce a short documentary, and start trying to get the word out there more.
You also told me before the tape started to roll that you're going to be making a move from one humble abode to another. You got to talk about that.
Okay. Well, yes, we're moving into a house in Echo Park that's about—
In California.
In California, Los Angeles. Yes, Echo Park. It's 610 square feet with our little 21-month-old. So it's definitely on the small, cozy side. But we're looking at this as a way to, A, you know, downsize a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We're going from 630 square feet to 610.
So you didn't live, you lived in far from a mansion in the—
We're used to living on boats. We're used to living
okay.
in small spaces. But
okay.
we're trying to, you know, incorporate as many recycled products as possible. We have, for example, 32 school bus windows from a junk school bus that we're incorporating into the house. We want to do gray water, which we did at our last place.
That means nothing to me.
We use a lot of water in our households for our showers, for our dishwashing.
That's a whole other issue, too.
Yeah. So it's pretty simple. I don't know about here in New York, but in L.A., where people have little gardens, you can just divert that water right out to your garden, make sure that you're using, you know, not toxic soap, and use it as a way to irrigate.
Terrific. And what else?
What else are we doing? Growing as much food as possible. That's something I'm really passionate about.
And it's easy, isn't it? I mean, people sometimes must think, oh, this is just too much work. I can't be bothered.
Again, it's about taking on simple things, whether your simple thing is just eating less meat or avoiding plastic straws or riding your bike and walking to work, taking on little actions that we know can make a difference, inspiring people around you and getting excited about taking on maybe bigger things.
Well, that's a great way to end because you really inspired me.
Well,
and I'm sure that you will inspire just everyone you come in contact with, you and your husband. What wonderful works
you two are
doing.
If people are excited, they can go to our website, 5gyres.org. They can see how to get involved in this Microbeads campaign, how to volunteer, and just educate themselves a bit more.
Spell Gyres, just for the uninitiated.
A good point. G-Y-R-E-S.
So it's the number 5, Gyres. Anna, thank you so much for opening our eyes and for the wonderful work that you do, you and your organization does. You really are inspirational.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.